This is The Conversation. I am Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. The brand newly designed website for the show is theconversationpod.com. Go check it out. Let us know what you think. I think you'll find it easier to navigate, and it's much more podcast-friendly. We also have reintroduced a page dedicated to your participation. It's a segment called Don't Call Us, which invites you to share your art or otherwise related stories and anecdotes. Check it out there. I want to thank Evangeline Cacinero down in Brisbane, Australia, who has been helping me, who has done most of the work in getting this site relaunched and redesigned. Thank you, Van, very much. And I also want to thank longtime supporter and friend of the show, Amir Fala, who provided me a platform up to this point. Thank you very much, Amir, for that. And these are some of the people that keep this podcast going. So you are always welcome to contribute if you have ideas of ways to contribute. I'm open to them. So today on the show, Kristen Morgan, the sculptor of unfired clay. You will hear something about integrity and sticking to your guns, probably more than any other conversation that we've had with an artist. And it has been a while. It's been some time since we've spoken with an artist. You may have noticed, dedicated listeners. Part of the reason for that is that thanks to another friend of the show, Sharon Loudon, I have had a string of New York-based people, dealer, critics, artist slash editor, on the show. And meanwhile, it's been surprisingly challenging at times going through referrals locally. There have been a surprising number of LA-based people that have been elusive, let's say, which may have something to do with the Los Angeles clause of non-participation, non-communication. In any case, we will probably have some more local people, local to Los Angeles, but I do like mixing it up. So actually next week, we are going to be having a New York-based person, and there's going to be some discussion of Miami and the art fairs. And that is all happening as this is coming out. It's actually in some ways winding down, as you will hear next week, since apparently the meat of the event happens earlier on with all the VIP activity. And I want to share a little anecdote with you about my sort of erstwhile involvement this year, a constant reminder that I am not there in Miami. I managed to get on to the VIP email list. Short story is basically I was a placeholder for a VIP ticket that eventually a couple of VIP tickets that became auction lots for a fundraiser. And so I was just a placeholder for those. And now, and at that time, I got on the email list. And I, meanwhile, tried to unsubscribe since I wasn't going. And you know, I didn't need to have this information. So I tried to unsubscribe maybe 4, 5, 6 times now. And I am still on the list. I got one just today. And so Michelle Sandoz, head of VIP and visitor services at Art Basel, if you are listening to this, just wanted to give you a heads up that, you know, while the fair is going on, maybe your web platform or database is overloaded because I am not able to unsubscribe. So I sent them a letter the other day. I thought I would share it with you. It says, it's simply, Dear Art Basel, I initially was connected with you as a VIP guest for this year, but it turned out I have not gone. Meanwhile, I have unsubscribed from your various email blasts several times, and yet I keep getting emails from you. This seems like a glitch in your system that should be pretty easy to fix. Wanted to bring it to your attention, and while I'm flattered by all the updates, I don't need them, so please see if you can unsubscribe me permanently until my status changes. Thank you very much for resolving this. Best. So, it hasn't been resolved, and I keep getting reminded that I am not there, so thank you very much. As if the fact that everybody in the art world in Los Angeles and on the internet in general doesn't remind us that we are not in Miami. So I hope you're all having fun down there, suffice to say. All right. Again, the website for the show, theconversationpod.com. And you can go see some great images of Kristen Morgan that are applicable to the conversation that we have with my co-host Deb Cloudman. Here that comes. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you on the back end. By the way, one last producer's note. The last about four and a half minutes are a little wonky, just to give you a heads up. It's not your speakers. Just a little technical glitch. Still going to be completely audible, though. Thank you very much. Talk to you later. This is The Conversation. Live in person, I should say, for a change. And I'm joined by frequent co-host, Deb Cloudman.
Hello, hello.
And our guest today is Kristen Morgan.
Hi.
Hi. Hi. There you go. I'm pretty sure that I saw your work for the first time, probably like a lot of people, in the show called Thing. That was that 2006?
2005.
2005.
Yep.
Wow, even earlier. So we're almost 10 years out now. And you had a life-size car made out of unfired clay.
That's correct.
Was that show a turning point for you?
As far as my work being kind of maybe more recognizable and my work being at least noticed or more well-known in Los Angeles, yes, that was sort of a turning point. As far as me...
I guess I meant career, too.
It was kind of like the beginning and the end of one career and the kind of like start of another one. Because at that point, I was... I was a full-time teacher at Cal State Long Beach. I taught in ceramics. I'd probably been teaching there for about 5 or 6 years. And then I would, you know, continue to teach there until 2009. And then I basically left my teaching job to just focus on my studio practice.
And oh, not allowed to use practice on this show.
No?
No.
Sorry.
It's all right.
I wasn't aware.
No, I know. That's totally unfair.
I also remember from a past thing that, what is it? There's a phrase that you really don't like that I say.
No worries?
Yeah, I fully say no worries. That's it.
Have you listened to the John Mellick episode yet?
I don't think I have.
Okay, well, we'll get back to you. Don't worry. You can cut all this out.
It's fine.
There was a recent episode with a PR guy who's Australian. Mm. He lives in New York, but he's...
Oh, did he explain?
Well, I asked him about it. It was the first thing I asked him about. And he said it's a total throwaway line.
Oh, yeah.
And so he says it all the time.
But it's
total bullshit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
So when somebody apologizes for something and you say no worries, you're saying fuck you.
Yeah. But
basically.
I don't use no worries like that.
Okay.
I think I use it in like...
Well, now you'll pay more attention.
Yeah, I'll pay more attention. Yeah. It's going to be
Philip,
really
do you think we should leave any of this in?
it's epic. Sorry,
it's epic. Okay, so anyway, your practice. What were you saying about your practice? Sorry. Your work.
Okay, my work. So I was starting to just really... 2009, I left my teaching job to just focus on
Wait,
my
2009?
Work.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but we're back at 2005, aren't we?
Well, okay, so that in 2005, I was in the Thing show, and prior to that point, you know, I had been working in ceramics, I'd been working with unfired clay, and I'd been having shows that were, you know, just as they would come. And I was in a spot where I wanted to try all this stuff with ceramics that, and when I say ceramics, I'm kind of, technically, I really just work with clay, and it doesn't really have much of a voice in the world of ceramics.
Well, it's good that you mentioned that, because I was going to say, what is the deal with ceramics?
Right.
Because it's like a little bit of a ghetto that it's definitely, though, been making headway, you know, in the last decade or so in various ways. But at the same time, if you had been a quote unquote ceramics artist, you may not have been put into that show. You know what I mean?
Well, Were there other ceramicists in
no,
that show?
I don't think no. so. No.
So, well, this is something, you know, I was actually talking to you about the other day. Is like, so I kind of, you know, as far as my work, and certainly definitely at that time, so there's this whole very long, very ancient tradition of ceramics in, you know, craft world that goes back like 4,000 years. And ceramics, you know, in their world of ceramics, and like, has always kind of wanted to kind of like progress further. But there's also this thing really within traditionalists in ceramics where they really want to hang on to the fact that it's different from sculpture, or it's, you know, so you can't take all the ceramics out of the ceramic and still have it be ceramic. So technically, clay is clay. And ceramics is fired clay, glazed clay. So, and clay is kind of like on the very bottom of the food chain as far as artistic medium. You know, even if you look at like sculpture, it's really like the means to an end. It's never what you use to use.
You're talking about hierarchically from a kind of expense sense?
Really, just as far as the material that people choose to make artwork out of, it's not one that people typically use. Because, A, it falls apart, it's not archival. I mean, and as far as value, it really is like the dirt you walk on. So it's...
Well, speaking of which, so going back to this car,
right?
What's the archival issue or situation, I should say, with that?
Well, so... I, you know, had started making these big, large-scale things made out of unfired clay, and it was more or less to just see if I could do them. I had ideas. I wanted to try this sort of thing. As far as maybe commercially, I had colleagues say, so long as you're working with those great, big, unfired clay sculptures, don't expect to ever have a show outside of Los Angeles. Don't expect to ever work with a commercial gallery, because nobody is going to want these things. And really, at that point, I was like, sounds great, because I had the opportunity to experiment. I had the opportunity to not really... I didn't have obligation to a gallery, to collectors, to anybody. Mm-hmm. To anybody except for, like, what I could do. And, you know, academia is this other kind of pressure. They were always sort of pressuring me to have, you know, you're supposed to keep up your artistic work. And the really way that you can be seen more is to have work in commercial venues or museums and things like that. So there's always this sort of push to maybe you could have a bigger venue. Maybe you won't be showing at a college or junior college next time. Maybe you'll show in a museum. And I always felt like I wasn't showing in big enough shows or that kind of thing. I felt that pressure when I was a teacher. And you're also expected to do a really good job teaching. But anyways, back to...
The car.
So when I made that car, it got an awful lot of attention because of that show. Yeah. I mean, that show was a really... It was a big thing. And then all of a sudden, there were a lot of galleries that were kind of approaching me.
That was why I asked that question in the first place. So you kind of discounted my question a little bit, but in fact, it did have a big impact on your career, right?
Well, that's what I meant. It sort of ended my teaching career.
Oh, I see.
And began, or you know, took a different turn for my artistic career. I felt like I was really always an artist. Teaching was something like I did, and like I said, you know, I didn't always feel competent at teaching.
Well, let's talk about that, because this is something that we were talking about before. Why has teaching been a challenge for you?
Well,
Or I should say was, because you're not teaching currently,
correct.
Right?
Yeah. So it was a challenge for me because there's so much more required of you as a university professor besides teaching. So you really have to have a full-time career as an artist, you have to have a full-time career as a teacher, and you kind of have to work at governing the school or the department or whatever, you know. So you're going to, so it was all the other stuff that I did, like working on committee meetings and, you know, just being bogged down with all the stuff that I did, wasn't actually engaging with students, you know. I mean, engaging with students is always something that was touch and go too, because I've, you know, I was really always had the best interests of my students at heart, but there were days when I knew, like, my piece of advice or whatever just was not the right thing to say, or, you know.
In retrospect, you realize
yeah,
that?
Yeah, you know, and you just worry
can
about...
Can you have a follow-up conversation, or is it too late at that point?
Well, you can, yeah. I have, and I did. I got better at that, where I just go back and I say, I think I just really... And sometimes you just, you don't really realize it until later, and somebody comes back and says, you know what you said to me? And I was like, oh, I didn't remember that, but I'm really sorry. And then, you know, she was like, no, no, it really helped me, or, you know, but I mean...
Oh, so you were bracing yourself and it turned out to be something
I mean,
good.
Sometimes, you know, it was just wasn't the right thing to say, and, you know, and you just, I really felt like I crushed people sometimes, but, you know, like...
What kind of things did you say that crushed people?
I can't really remember specific things, but I know, like, when I got out of graduate school, I had a really hard time in graduate school because I was at a very traditional place. The kind of work that I was making was very untraditional. And it was just, you know, it was a ceramic mecca, and it was not the place to say, I think I'm not going to fire my work for the whole time that I'm here. What do you think of that? And... my teachers, you know, they gave me like a really hard time. I had critiques where they would come in, they'd say, did you fire anything yet? And I would say no, and they would leave. That was the end of the conversation.
Well, I'm sure it felt like a direct and rejection.
Of
to
course,
them.
Of course, yeah. You know, and it was just like, well, I don't know if it was a direct rejection of them necessarily, but
of that history.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean... Yeah, but it was, you know, it was harsh sometimes.
Well,
so I got out of graduate school and I was harsh, you know, was just
right.
Kind of like...
Let's backtrack for a second, yeah. Though, because I'm curious about you being in this classical ceramics program.
Right.
Do you think you were doing the unfired thing sort of to be rebellious, or were you kind of like... That's just the direction you wanted to go in, and maybe it didn't have anything to do with what else was going on there.
Well, I got there, and I was firing things, and I was kind of glazing things, and I was just continuing where I left off, you know. And as teachers will do in graduate school, they kind of encourage me to switch directions. And so I just, you know... I just kind of went wherever my work was taking me. And at the time...
So the irony is that they were actually encouraging you to go in that direction.
Well, they were encouraging me to do something different.
Right.
And it was something different.
But not that different.
Yeah. But they were like, well, we meant to go this way, not that.
And that's brilliant.
So I... But it really felt true to me. And I think that it's part of the way... People are taught in graduate school where you're just sort of, you're left really naked. Gradually every single one of your devices that you use to make art are just taken away from you. You just aren't allowed to do those things anymore until you're left fighting for something that's really important to you that you just can't have somebody take away from you. And so in that respect, that's kind of, you know, that, now going, I mean, it was a really great experience because it taught me to really learn that this is what I want to do. This is how I'm going to justify it. And this is honest to me. And this is the direction that I should go.
Mm-hmm.
So that was more or less my experience in graduate school. But
were you making large scale things at that point, or were they still mostly?
The largest thing that I made was maybe... like human-sized kind of thing. And there was some rebellion going on, too, because I was often often criticized for using materials that were not clay. So I would make things out of clay, but I would also use old metal and wood. And they're like, this is mixed media. This isn't ceramics. And so what I started to do was I started to make clay look a lot like wood or all the other materials that I wanted to use. And I figured if they couldn't tell where clay was going to start and stop, it would sort of fly. And that was the kind of rebellion in it. And really towards the end, I was really embittered. I was really like, and that's not really a good place to be, where you're just like, I don't care what you have to say. I'm not going to listen to anything. I mean, that's awful too. But I mean, now, you know, some 20 years later or whatever, I mean, I think it was a really great experience.
Yeah. For me. I wonder if you were trying to get out of the ceramic ghetto, you know?
Well, I don't know if ceramics is a ghetto. I mean, I really wouldn't call it that, because it's got like 4,000 years of history.
I wouldn't say ghetto. But I would say what we were talking about when we talked earlier about the idea of it there being this craft association that is in some ways breaking down, so that it is seen as sort of a separate category that can be very confining within the context of the larger.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is a kind of, you could say ghetto in quotes, in various quotes. Okay. But basically we're talking about the way that ceramics is ghettoized by the art establishment, by the art world. And that if you're, let's just say that your colleagues at this ceramics school where you were doing graduate school, right? Let's just say you were all undergraduates. If you as a group applied to like a UCLA or a Columbia or someplace like that, you would all be rejected because you were in the ceramic ghetto. You might not be because of this rebellion that you were doing, but you see what I'm saying?
I know what you're talking about. Yeah. There's a sort of hierarchy, the sculpture is kind of at the top of everything, and then, you know, painting, and then, you know, ceramics.
I wouldn't necessarily say that. Where did you get that idea?
I got that idea from UCLA, but...
Oh, no. Well, actually, that's... Okay, that's fair. UCLA's thing is that, yeah, if you're not a painter, painting is dead. Generally the sort of Charles Ray, Chris Bird, and Paul McCarthy school is sort of the high mark. But just in the world in general... That's not how the hierarchy works. It's much more mixed, I would say, first of all. Sure, maybe that's UCLA's.
I think it could be, in other places as well.
So if you were going to finish that metaphor, you would say ceramics is at the bottom of that hierarchy?
It's kind of, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The idea of, not to keep making this idea of it as being seen as a craft, but it makes me think of, CCAC taking craft off the end of the name of the school. And now there is this way in which ceramics, I think, is becoming appropriated and more exciting, but only within very specific avenues and contexts.
Right. You know? There is a kind of renaissance of ceramics and in contemporary art. I wanted to say, I think that my work kind of is in this weird place where it's not wholeheartedly accepted within the world of ceramics. And it's also a real weird thing to have in the world of contemporary art. And I was telling you the other day, I really felt like the bouncer was totally asleep on the day that I walked through the door of contemporary art. I was just, and... If you
what
really,
day was that?
Well, it was like the thing show,
right.
And that was, and there's this kind of, I look at galleries that are around and things that people show, and there's, my work is so weird in that world. It just looks so strange, and it is. I mean, it's really like, it's, it's a difficult thing to own because it can break so easily. It's a difficult thing to sell. I mean, I have a really great gallerist who I work for who has a lot of faith in me and a lot of faith in the work too. And he really kind of like appreciates the sort of honesty in it. And
can I stop you there?
Yeah.
Did you notice anything about the wording that she just used by any chance? Did you catch that?
Oh, I did.
Yeah.
The work for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's, I don't think that's unnotable. You said this gallerist I work for, as opposed to this
him.
Gallerist I work with. So that suggests that you have to take all of his decisions, you know, to heart and follow most of them. To me,
I'm gonna say the other side of that. I'm gonna be the another way of looking that would be more of a. Working for, in the sense of actually viewing this person's belief in you as a positive force that is helping to propel your work.
Yeah.
How's that for?
I honestly.
But yeah, I feel like both things are totally.
Yeah, I think that was implied, you know, especially because of what you said afterwards. But mm-hmm. I mean, since you use those words, it's interesting to think about the dynamic.
Well, what does, since you were talking about the kind of freedom that you really enjoyed before this sort of career turning point that we're talking about, and not having to work for with a commercial gallery in mind, how was that transition once it actually happened? And once you had all of these galleries kind of courting you in the aftermath of that show.
Well, immediately in the aftermath of that show, I said no to everybody, including the gallerist who I currently am working with. I was just like, I don't want to sell this. And I told the Hammer Museum, I was like, don't, I don't want to sell this work. I enjoy it. I made it. I want to live with it. I want to put my mail on it. I want to see it every day. Even if it's in a storage place, I mean, that's what I want to do with it. So,
how did you come to be in this place where you were so in love with your work? Because I think a lot of people listening right now are going, fuck you. You're not supposed to love your work that much. A little more self-doubt.
I do have tons of self-doubt.
All right, well, let's talk about that. Let's put a little emphasis on the self-doubt.
I mean, I just, every time I have it, I mean, well, definitely, you know, your sort of perspective changes a lot when I'm currently earning my living making my work, and so I try not to be too mindful of, you know, but
I wonder, I wonder if at that time, partially because, if not largely because of that show, you were feeling like really particularly confident, and that had something to do with your perspective on your work. And then in turn that, you know, you wanted to not be compromised by commercial relationships.
I definitely did not want to feel compromised. I think I felt compromised or at least pressured to do things that I didn't want to do when I was in graduate school. Plenty, you know, and I just felt like, and honestly, like I was really lucky because I got a full-time teaching position almost directly out of graduate school. And that also had to do with somebody's utter faith in me and...
Your teachers?
No, well, the people who worked at Cal State Long Beach who hired me, you know. I mean, because there were other more experienced people that were there, and they really felt like I was the best person for the job. So, I mean, so I definitely didn't want to compromise things with a gallery. I think I had earlier experiences with other galleries that I was sort of working with where I was kind of creeped out early on by the ideas that collectors could kind of dictate how they wanted you to make work. And a gallerist could also do that. And I had this full-time teaching job that was giving me some kind of steady income. I always felt like I was going to lose the job because I didn't feel quite competent enough at it, but it was there nonetheless, and it did make me feel like I could try all these unconventional ways of working with ceramics, and I didn't have to worry about it. And so at the point when people were starting to approach me about showing my work, I was immediately afraid that I had had an experience with a smaller gallery where things were sent back to me because the people who had bought them wanted me to fire the work so that they could put it in their bathroom so their children wouldn't break it, you know? And the ironic thing is with ceramics, certainly it has this long history of being something that breaks.
Yeah. So, what was your response?
No.
And what was the reaction to that response?
Well, I think I really don't know. That was the last I heard of it. It just came back to the, I was working with this kind of small gallery, and the work came back to her, and she said, would you consider the possibility of firing this work? And also, ironically, with my work, if you take what I do to clay and then you put it into a kiln, it will completely destroy the work. Mm. It won't make it. It's not like the paint will stay there. It's not like any of that will stay there.
You're talking about current work, too?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, like those cars and things like that. Like, basically, a lot of what's holding it up is there's a wooden structure and a structure made out of wire that would all go away. I mean, there's glue also mixed into that clay, but I don't do that so much anymore. Current work is just so fragile. I mean, it's some of it I make as thin as a potato chip, and there's nothing but like hope keeping those things together sometimes.
But it's established that you aren't going to do anything so that children can play with it.
Right, not at this juncture. I mean, no. I mean, I never want to say never because, you know, as soon as you start saying, I don't do this, then you start doing that.
Yeah. Then you're confronted by a situation. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, should we then talk about the point that you decided to show with the gallery? And
sure.
Yeah.
So what happened?
What made you? Yeah, go ahead.
Was, can I say the name of the gallerist?
Okay.
Okay. So I work with Mark Sowen, Fine Art, and he had approached me during the Thing show. And he said, you know, I'm a fan. Anytime you want to do something with me in the gallery, like, I would love to do a show with you. Come down. Come look at my show right now. I think you're going to really love it. And
did you?
I did. And I did really love it. It was Robert Overby, who's kind of really got his name in graphic design. But then after that, he kind of really went into the world of fine art. And he had taken basically this house and made all these, like, latex. He just painted latex on parts of this abandoned house and then would peel them off. And it was really beautiful, amazing work. And so, but then, so I was like, yeah, well, I'm not really interested in working with a gallery at this point. And he said, I've heard everything, I know, but if you ever are, let me know. So for about a year, there was this kind of courtship kind of going on where he would say, hey, come down to the gallery. I really think you're going to love this show. And hey, maybe we should do something sometime. You don't have to do anything, you know? And then at some point I was with a group of students that I had taken to the Venice Biennale, and I ran into him there, and he said, Hey, why don't we just do something? And at this point, And at this point, it had been a year. He kind of, you know, but, and he's like, listen, we will try something. You don't have to sell everything in the show. It'd be nice if you sold something. We'll try it once. Oh, we'll see how we like it one another. If you don't like it, you don't ever have to do it again. And we'll part ways, and that'll be that. And I said, okay. And he's like, yeah, when you get back to the States, give me a call. We'll do something. And I said, okay. So we had a show, and that was around 2006. And I think I didn't really want to sell the work that was in the show. And
because you wanted to live with it?
Yeah.
Put your mail on it?
Yeah, kind of. And I
love that.
Yeah. But I was
put your mail inside it.
Yeah. I do live. I mean, that car that was in the thing show, I still live with.
Wow.
It makes me really want to see pictures of your house.
Well,
we're not studio. Having our studio visit with you now.
Yeah, it's kind of a crazy place. And there's a lot of work that I do still keep. You know, it's not the largest thing in the world. But just because I want to live with it, or, you know. So anyways, we had the show, and I said, I will sell this piece and this piece. And he said, okay, that's fine. And there was maybe, you know, there were like maybe five kind of relatively large scale pieces in the show. He was really great about, you know, if it was a large piece, he really wanted it to try to go to a museum or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, there's one piece that was sold to a museum. Another piece was sold to collectors who, they have a huge collection that they have their own museum too. And so they ended up buying things, and it was kind of like, well, he would say, I know you didn't want to sell this piece, but there's this really great collector who would really love to have this. And I think your work would look great in this collection. Mm. And he's always really good about, you know, you can say no if you want to. And there were occasions when I did say no. So then we did a show, we did maybe another show. And at some point he said to me, you know, what do you want? You know, like, really, if you could have anything, what do you want? You know, do you want to do more shows? Do you want to work more teaching? I mean, at that point, I was a full-time teacher. I had tenure. I mean, the whole nine yards. And I said, I think what I said at the time is, I want to have enough shows that I could have a big enough space that I could keep all my work and live with it. And he's like, okay, let's do that.
Which would put him out of the equation, though, wouldn't it?
I mean, I guess, but I mean,
let me help you do that.
He was, you know, totally enthusiastic with whatever I wanted to do, and so he said, you know, do you really need to teach as much as you do? Could you think about maybe teaching part time? And I'd like to do more shows with you, and I can help you earn enough money that you can buy this big place, you can have your museum, you know, and live in it. And so I told him no. And I kind of really thought about
it. Hard to get.
I kind of did. And he will attest to that. Yeah, I really did.
And that was the right move, apparently.
But a year later, during the recession, I was looking at like a pile of paperwork and budgets that I was trying to balance, and thinking about a conversation I had with a student that I had really messed up, and watching cobwebs grow in my studio, and feeling like, I know I'm not put on this planet to balance this budget. Yeah. And to do all this other stuff.
Just for detail's sake, were you given the balancing budget, or did all of your colleagues have to deal with that as well?
I mean, balancing a budget is kind of like a sort of more general term for basically governing the department. You know, you're asked to participate in various meetings and hire people and review people and decide who's going to go on sabbatical and, you know, work on various committees, things like that. So that's just sort of a, when I say balancing a budget, I'm talking about all that other work.
Right.
That,
so you were, and you were being overwhelmed by it.
I was being overwhelmed by it. And as, when you get tenure, you kind of, as you're working towards it, you really feel like, this is, you know, I'm just paying my dues right now. It's all going to kind of like even out once I get tenure. And then once you get tenure, there's a lot of stuff that people who don't have tenure can't do those jobs, but only people with tenure can do those jobs. So there's just like a lap and all that work goes right into it. And I mean, that's kind of the deal.
And then you see the continuing to pay dues in perpetuity.
Right.
In front of you.
Right. Yeah. You know, and there's also this thing too in academia that where if you're good at a job that you don't really, you try to do your best. You always try to do your best. And if you do good at a job that you don't particularly like or that you don't feel that you're good at, you're going to be asked to do that job over and over and over again because you're kind of, you showed that you put effort forth. And so it's kind of like this never-ending cycle of being stuck in this world of work. And it's a rich, rich life as a college professor. But it's really, like, I got to the point where I was just like, I just don't think I'm cut out for all of this other stuff. I was, I don't know, 40 years old. And at that time, and I was like, I'm got this opportunity. Maybe I should try to do something with it. So I went back to Mark and I said, okay, so we're in a recession. A year ago, you said I could leave my job and I could work with you and I could earn my living with you. You selling it and me making it. And I says, is that deal still on the table? And he said, sure. He really almost did not skip a beat. He was just like, sure, let's do it. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to go quit my job. He's like, sure, go for it.
So you quit before you had a show?
So, I can't remember if I had a show lined up at that point, I quit my job.
How did that go? Were they surprised?
Some people were. Some people just felt like, oh, maybe that's probably a really good decision for you, and right on. Yeah. And you know, somebody has to do it, and so there were a lot of people, I think, maybe cheering for me. There were a lot of people that, you know, I mean, maybe it's like cheering for the underdog because hardly are people. I mean, not everybody's successful doing what, you know, knock on wood, what I'm doing right now. And it can be kind of dicey because you just never know. And you really, like, I always want to stay fresh and pertinent. And how do I continue that, with every show that I do, you know, outwork myself every show that I do, you know, I always want it to get better. And, so those are kinds of things that are on my mind and concerns for me and stuff like that. But I've been really lucky, in that shows that I've done thus far, you know, really, they've gone well. I'm kind of, it's sort of Mark's idea. You know, he's a really, really good at seeing the big picture of things a lot of times, and he will do things that may not benefit him immediately, but he sees it as benefit in the long run, that kind of thing. And so his idea is to maybe do a show with me, maybe on average once every other year, And then in the years when I'm not showing with him, maybe have a more long time kind of gallery in another city that I might work with, that he works with too. And I would do shows in another city like New York or San Francisco when I'm not doing a show here with him.
Mm-hmm.
So since I've quit my job, then you know, another thing that's difficult about just really, you know, making my living selling my work is really I have a show, a solo show, sometimes two, you know, like every year. And and I'm the type of person, I really like a lot of clutter. And to try and build that critical mass with every show is really hard to do every single year. You don't get, when I was teaching, I would have a show, but then I would have a long period of sort of incubation and kind of rejuvenating and thinking of different directions. And you don't really get time to kind of mull things over before your next show is coming up. So, I mean, I do get a lot of choice. Like, I think Mark is really great for whatever you want to do, we'll do it. So if you're not ready for that show or whatever, we won't do it. You know, if you, you know, think you can do these two shows, you can do it. You know, we'll do it. And you also get a lot of opportunity, or I've gotten a lot of opportunities, and there's a lot of stuff a lot of times that you just, you can't say no to. They're all big things, and they all come down the pike at the exact same time. And so it can get really kind of crazy.
I'm sure anxiety producing too, in the sense that if they are big opportunities, you want to, as you said, you want to keep it fresh. You want to show right. up for each one of them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. Totally. Is that part of the reason why you feel the impulse to want to live with your work and hold on to it too? What you said about you like building up clutter. Do you feel like you're like it, you work better when you feel like you're not starting from scratch, when you already have kind of an existing kind of body around you?
Yeah, maybe that's part of it. You know, just seeing what I've done and kind of reminding myself, you know, like I forget a lot of times, but I am very prolific.
Yeah.
But I always think I'm not. And so it's not until I go back and I kind of like, I have a lecture to do and I right. look at like my work and I go, I made a lot of work. And, you know, so I kind of, but to have it around me too, it all kind of gets mixed in with everything, like the mail and, you know,
yeah.
everything. So it all kind of
builds off just, of each other.
I think I just really like a mess.
Yeah.
You know, and actually right now my studio is about, the cleanest it's been in my whole career. But when I was in graduate school, I literally had like, a foot of rubble
yeah.
that was on the floor of my studio. I was the girl with the messiest studio. It
yeah.
was just like, there was dried clay, dried glaze, wet clay. There was all kinds of junk that I would bring in from out in the forests, you know, so there was like deer skulls and animal bones and pieces of rusty metal and yeah. old toys, and people would donate things, you know, and so I would have, you know, all that junk, and I'd just throw it all on the floor. And and again, back to my teachers with their rough critiques, we would have critiques where we would spend the whole time talking about the mess
right.
in my studio.
And I got get past
to
that.
The point where I was like, I only have two critiques yeah. a year, and one of them I can't even be, we weren't allowed to be in the building for.
Oh, wow.
And so I was like, you have to talk about the work.
Yeah.
So what I did is I took a bunch of cinder blocks and a bunch of little pieces of plywood, and I laid the cinder blocks down, and I built a second floor over the existing rubble.
So
I
felt you had like a platform. I needed,
yeah. And so the sort of pressure to kind of like fire my work and glaze it, and I mean, it just was being hammered into my head so much that I like I said, at the end of my experience there, I really just wanted to, any way that they said to go, I wanted to go the contrary.
Since you've been in the, since your work has entered this sort of more commercial realm, and, you know, you're working with Mark Selwyn here and then having shows in New York and San Francisco, have you had people over to the studio who, since they're approaching it from the more commercial side and possibly less academic side, who have, has that ever felt like a weird intersection for you, or has it been relatively smooth?
Well, so when I'm, I am constantly being asked to explain,
right?
Especially now, because there was a, like when I was making those cars and those big things, everything kind of, it looked like a car, but the clay was also trying to be, look like itself.
Right.
And there was something in the way things deteriorated and fell apart, and the dirt and stuff like that, that initially I started making work like that because I wanted to replicate how I thought music sounded. And so I was making these musical instruments, and they looked dirty and fragile, and it seemed to really make sense to me, like, that it looked like how I thought the music sounded.
Right.
And then it just sort of became a way of working for me. But then, you know, I'm making old records that I have, and I'm trying to paint them as closely as I possibly can to the real thing. And there's no reason for me to do that. I can do that with a piece of wood or metal or something like that. Why am I sticking with the unfired clay? And I think the reason is because I'm also really wanting to talk about a kind of value.
Right.
Literally what I make is painted dirt, you know, and it's this kind of rarity, and it's a hard thing to kind of keep in the world. And really what I love so much about the work is that it's mortal.
Right.
and its mortality is really kind of as it would be for you and I. When you're speaking to people, everything in the world is temporary. We are accustomed to thinking that art is going to stay forever, but it's not. And so when I really am enamored when people try to keep something in the world that really has seen its time, you know, and the kind of sometimes loss of dignity of that thing, or even a person.
Yeah, living where we live.
Right.
Yeah.
And then just in general, when I speak to people, I'm not thinking about their mortality, but my subconscious is always aware that it's there. And so in that way, that's why I'm sticking to the unfired clay and the paint, is because I really kind of like that about it.
Yeah.
So, but I'm asked to explain that over and over again.
Why you're doing that when you could do something else. Yeah.
People in the commercial world are not always really accustomed to having to deal with that. But then there's a lot of people in the commercial world that love to deal with that kind of thing, because it's really, you know, it's the thing that they can't quite have. And they like the challenge of trying to keep this thing, you know, Fritz Corraldo kind of thing in the world. So, yeah.
That's a good image.
Yeah, it is. It's a very, very good image.
Thank you very much for talking to us, Frisa.
Thank you.
So thank you, Deb.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thank you, Philip.
Thanks, Philip.
Yay.
And
we're out.
Thank you very much again to Kristen for talking to us and putting it all out there. Again, the website, theconversationpod.com, you can, I would really appreciate your support in one of a number of ways. As you know, you can support the show financially. Donations are very, very welcome, even if it's as little as $10.
You can do that through PayPal, through the website. Of course, you can also become a fan on the various social media outlets at Artist Podcast on Instagram and Twitter, and you can, of course, become a fan on Facebook. You can also write a nice review on iTunes, which is linked through the site, which brings more people to the show. Of course, word of mouth is great, too. And one thing that I have said recently, which I will say again, is if you can do nothing else other than get one friend or colleague to also subscribe to this show, grab their smartphone away from them, go to the Stitcher or iTunes page for the Conversation Artist Podcast and subscribe for them, that is a great way to help us grow and have more listeners and turn more people onto the show. So if you can do that, God bless you. Let us know you did it. You know, we'll give you a shout out. Check out Don't Call Us on the new website. And I think that's about it for now. Thank you very much for listening. As always, especially you regulars, really appreciate you guys. And I will talk to you next Saturday. Ciao for now.